You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We'd all like to believe that life can be like the fairy tales that end with marriages and living happily ever after, but it would be helpful if we had some idea of how we might carry that off. Tara Parker Pope's latest book, For Better, addresses the state of matrimony scientifically and evaluates what exactly makes good marriages work. It's published by Dutton, and I'm so pleased that it brings Ms. Parker Pope back to our show today. Welcome back.
I'm happy to be here. Always happy to be here.
When I say scientifically, there a lot of scientists have been looking into marriage over the years.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising. You wouldn't think that science and marriage really goes together, but there are a lot of social scientists and economists and psychologists and all kinds of researchers who have really been studying married couples in different ways. Some of them put couples in a laboratory setting and say, okay, now fight. And they actually will do that on demand. It's kind of funny. And they'll be attached to maybe a blood pressure cuff, and they'll take blood and, you know, a heart monitor, and they'll, you know, have people tracking their facial expressions. And from those interactions, they study enough of them, they get some pretty good ideas about what's going on in happy marriages and unhappy marriages.
So when they say fight, the people, I imagine, just go back to a fight that has never been resolved. Well,
what they do, it's kind of interesting. They get together with these couples, and they have them fill out questionnaires, and they find the issue that makes them bicker. And they find issues that are not hot buttons. So it might be like they talk about the dog as a control setting. You know, they're happy talking about the dog. But then they say, okay, now talk about your mother-in-law. And I was talking to one researcher from Ohio State who said, you know, I never really believed that this would work, but they're really happy just to go at it. You know, every researcher I've talked to said the same thing. It's never a problem to get couples to start arguing in front of you.
But there are couples who say they never fight.
Certainly. And it's one thing, one of the lessons from the study of conflict in married couples is that a little conflict can be good and healthy for a relationship. But it's also how you define conflict. I mean, I think a relationship that has no conflict but also really has no interaction at all and no real working of things, you know, working out of things, that's not necessarily a healthy relationship. So a little conflict is good, but there are definitely happy couples that don't fight. But I still believe that a little conflict goes a long way in a relationship.
As in fairy tales, do people tend to be overly optimistic about marriage? Your book is For Better, not For Better or Worse, and it says the science of good marriage. So I would assume that this book has a kind of an optimistic outlook.
Well, you know, it didn't start that way. It started at the when I was going through a divorce, and I was trying to find answers about my own relationship and sort of make sense of this thing that had happened to me, and I was looking for evidence-based advice. And so I started it from kind of a negative place, but I was surprised at how much good news there really is about marriage and that marriage is getting stronger. And so I think there is a lot of good news and a lot of reason to be optimistic about marriage.
Well, don't most of us believe that unlike all those people whose marriages end in divorce, ours will be different?
Well, I don't know. I think people generally accept that there's a 50% divorce rate. I mean, that's a common belief system out there that
half of marriages. But you said that's not true.
It's absolutely a myth. You know, there are groups of people that have this, you know, high school grad, you know, people married under 25 who dropped out of college or didn't finish high school, those people are going to have a 50% divorce rate. Couples married in the 1970s, they have about a 47% divorce rate. They're probably going to hit 50%. But couples married in the 80s, especially the 90s, more recent marriages, it's a different things are going on, and marriage is getting stronger. The divorce rate is changing. And the divorce rate peaked in the 1970s, clearly, at about 23 divorces per 1,000 couples. Down now to about 17, 16 per 1,000. So divorce is getting less common.
Well, also, I've always wondered about that. If we add Mickey Rooney, if we put Mickey Rooney next to somebody who's never gotten a divorce, we still have, if he was married six times and divorced six times, that's three divorces there.
Right. And this is the problem when you look at second marriages, you know. And as somebody who was divorced once and would certainly hope to get it right the second time around, I was really interested in the statistics on second marriages. And people will tell you that the divorce rate in a second marriage is actually worse than in first marriages. It's not technically accurate, because the problem you have with second marriage statistics is that you are going to get people like that. You're going to get the Elizabeth Taylors and the Larry Kings of the world that are essentially serial marriers and divorcers, if those are two words. And so that really skews the statistics. So when you take out these kind of risky prospects that are going to skew you off the charts, when you take them out, you're probably going to see that second marriages are as stable or possibly even stronger than first marriages.
Although you once told me that third marriages tend to be the best because in the first marriage, you blame the spouse for the problems. The second marriage, you realize that you were responsible to some degree, at least 50% for what went wrong. The third marriage, you then go into with an understanding that you've got to work at it as hard as the other person.
Yeah, I don't know if there's actually any data to support my statement, I have to say, but I always joke that I would like to be a third wife because I think that by then, the problem with being the third wife, though, is that he's incredibly poor at that point, so I'm not sure I would recommend that for
all
everybody.
All the alimony.
Yeah.
There used to be a column in Good Housekeeping magazine called Can This Marriage Be Saved, which told the story of a particular marriage and its problems, but the answer was always that the marriage could be saved. So is that true? Is that just what we want to hear?
Well, I think any marriage can probably be saved if both people want to save it. I mean, I think that's where it starts. It's very hard to sort of make generalizations about any individual marriage. Every marriage is unique and special and different. And I think the reason you study large groups of couples and you study the science of marriage is because you're looking for patterns and trends that can help you and inform you. But only you really know what goes on in your marriage. And I often say there are many marriages that science cannot explain, and we've all seen them. So, this is advice and this is information that can help you make decisions. And I think if you're both very motivated and you love each other and you want to be together, you can be together.
You said that divorce rates are going down. I would think that one of the reasons is something I've heard, that more people are living together and not getting married. So that would mean that the ones who get married are the ones who are pretty sure that they will succeed.
That's right. There's a selection pressure going on right now because people are delaying marriage and marrying later in life, the relationships that are troubled are essentially washing out before they get to the altar. So the people that actually get to the point of saying, I do, we're selecting for stronger relationships and they're more likely to stay married. And that's one explanation for why the divorce rate is dropping.
You mentioned bickering before. One of the most amazing numbers in your book is on the percentage of marital conflicts that never get resolved. Now, what do you mean by that? Do they just continue to fester, or does the fight continue ad infinitum, or is it just that people feel they've had their say, the air is cleared, and now they want to move on?
Yeah, probably a little of all of that. This is based on a finding by John Gottman, a marriage researcher in Seattle, who is quite well known. There are many, many marriage researchers. He's just one. But he's probably best known because he was one of the first to really put couples in a laboratory setting and study them. Before that, a lot of the data from the science of marriage was coming from therapists who were seeing troubled couples. So what Gottman did is he put sort of all different types of couples in front of him, and he started studying how they interacted. And one of his findings is that as he was tracking these couples, he realized that over time that, they would come into his lab and he would watch what they were arguing about, and they would come back 10 years later and they were still arguing about pretty much the same thing. And I think anybody who's married kind of gets this. It's not entirely surprising. People don't change tremendously. So, but the good news in that
statistic, but it doesn't break them up.
No, and I think that's an important thing to remember and to realize, that conflict is often not what matters when you're fighting with your partner. It's not what you're fighting about. It's not how often you fight. Now, obviously, if there's abuse or it's highly negative, but we're talking about the kind of everyday run-of-the-mill arguments you have with a partner, those issues are not important. What's important is how you fight. How does the fight start? How does it finish? The topic doesn't really matter.
But staying on fighting fair would be an important consideration. Staying on topic, not suddenly saying, I always hated your mother, and bring in all the other things that have bothered you over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of lessons from the science of conflict. And one is that you really need to learn the difference between complaining about something, a legitimate complaint, and criticizing someone. And it's subtle. You never call when you work late. You're so responsible. I don't trust you. And that's a different fight than saying, I was worried about you. I wish you would call me when you're running late. Let's talk about this. It sets a totally different tone. Or it upset me that you didn't help me clean up after the party. That's going to be a very different fight than saying, you're such a slob and, when are you going to start helping around the house?
My guest is Tara Parker Pope, author of The Well column, one of the New York Times' most popular and most emailed journalists. Her column is constantly in one of the top two or three columns that is emailed. She has written a book called For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage. It's published by Dutton. Tolstoy said that all happy families are basically alike. I get the feeling that he was totally wrong on that.
I think it is totally wrong. It's funny because that quote comes up a lot when you're reading these papers on marriage science and relationship. And people, you know, there are common patterns we see that we can learn from. So there are behaviors that are similar. But each, you know, marriage deals with it differently. Each person deals with it differently. And in gender, you know, the issues come into play. So people are definitely different, and there's a lot of variables that influence marriage.
Well, you mentioned that you're divorced, and you talk about your marriage, which was a long one in the book. And on paper, you and your husband were totally compatible. Isn't compatibility important?
You know, I think this is one of the most interesting things I learned as I was doing this research, that we hear a lot. In fact, if you ask my husband today why we got divorced, actually, it's very funny because I would probably give you 10 very specific reasons. And he would say, oh, well, we're just not compatible. And it's that word, compatibility, we're not compatible, that comes up a lot in unhappy couples. But what's interesting is they've actually studied couples who get divorced, who stay married. A man named Ted Houston out in, I think it's the University of Texas at Austin, studied a lot of couples. And he found that there was no difference. Excuse me, couples were not more or less compatible if they divorced or they stayed married. So really, it's just a red flag showing that you're unhappy in a relationship.
You feel that there's something that's going wrong, and that is a sign of incompatibility.
Right, and you know, if you think about what this means, you know, often when a person gets divorced, they usually own a house together. They might have kids, a dog, they've got tax returns, they've got, you know, shared vacation and family and relationships and friendships. That is compatibility, if you ask me. But you start just expressing dissatisfaction.
What about commitment, monogamy? Some people say it isn't a natural state, but it really can destroy a marriage. Or, I mean, infidelity can destroy a marriage.
I love this debate because every time you start talking about commitment and monogamy and fidelity, you always get a vocal group of people saying this is not natural. We're not meant to be faithful. You know, this is just not natural. It doesn't occur in nature. The truth is, it does occur in nature. 5% or so of mammals are monogamous, and you have a few examples of, you know, highly faithful animals like the California mouse. But I find it amusing.
You're comparing us with mice?
Well, what's amusing to me is that people would say, well, because rabbits and squirrels aren't monogamous, then I don't have to be. Since when do human beings compare themselves to the lower creatures? And I think what distinguishes us from the lower creatures is our ability to make choices, and you know, we're extraordinary in so many ways, so why not pursue monogamy?
You include a description of a rather horrifying mouse experiment about monogamy.
This made me a little sad, I have to say. The California mouse is highly loyal, and it's a much studied little creature. What they did is that they took these mice that form these strong pair bonds, and they put them in a situation where they had essentially a little mouse seduction, an attempt by a temptress to woo the mouse. And what was interesting, the male mouse just never, in one set of these experiments, they actually had the partner mouse in the cage but unable to get to her partner. So the poor little guy is sort of in the middle with his beloved on one side and the temptress on the other. But he did the right thing. He's a good little mouse, and he stayed loyal. It's a remarkable study because it's 100% loyalty. He's a monogamous little creature.
Well, you have a thing in this book that you also included in today's column in the New York Times about showing people the words L-O-A-L and T-H-R-T. And some people read local and throat, and others read loyal and threat. I assume that mouse was a loyal and threat kind of mouse.
Yeah, I mean, these are words that psychologists use to sort of get at your subconscious feelings. And we've seen studies looking at racism and stereotypes, and there's different, you know, ways you complete puzzles depending on your sort of underlying subconscious feelings. And they do this with these commitment and threat words. And they find that depending on, you know, in these studies, they prime people. They put them in a situation saying, okay, so your girlfriend's away for the weekend, and here's what's going on, and you have this opportunity. And they try to mentally get them into the place where they're feeling, there's an opportunity to stray from their relationship. And then what they find is that that typically when women are in this situation, they tend to see in these word fragments and these puzzles, they tend to see the commitment words, and the men don't. And what that suggests is that women are just more in tune, that we react differently when we perceive a threat to our relationship. We're faster to react to a perceived threat to our relationship.
My guest is Tara Parker Pope. Her latest book, For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage, published by Dutton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Tara Parker Pope, author of the New York Times Well column and Well blog. Her latest book, For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage. It's published by Dutton. Well, we've been talking about monogamy. There are certain types of male, so we read about them in the newspaper, who seem to be unable to remain faithful. Does science say that that's actually the case?
The tough thing about studying human fidelity is that you can't sort of track them the way you can rodents or, other animals and creatures. So you have to just ask, and people probably do lie, and I think that's a given. But when they look at the data over time, it's remarkably consistent. And so the bottom line is that most people don't cheat. In a given year, about 10% of people report being unfaithful in their relationship, which is not, 90% of people are not cheating. And I think
more it's likely to be male than female, or
male
is it...
men are more have higher rates of infidelity, slightly higher rates of infidelity, but they think that it may just be that women are better at lying about it. They're not necessarily convinced that women are cheating. The thing about women is that women have fewer opportunities to cheat, so their numbers are always going to be a little lower because they tend to be the caregivers of children. I think most people who study this don't think women are more or less faithful. They just have fewer opportunities to
stray. But then there comes the next aspect of that, and that is you discovered that your partner has been unfaithful. And some people get divorced, some people don't. And we judge some of the people who don't get divorced. We've seen that in the case of the Clintons, for example. She was criticized for not leaving Bill.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's fair because, every marriage has its own sort of special issues. And there are actually, in surveys of couples, there are, a fairly large number of couples say they have survived infidelity. Fidelity and faithfulness is the most important quality in the success of a marriage based on research. The Pew Research has there have been several surveys on what couples value in a marriage. Fidelity is always off the charts on the top. So people care about it. It's definitely important to people, but that doesn't mean that it's a deal killer. It's very tough to get over. Definitely it's a challenge for a relationship because people do value commitment and faithfulness. So, that's every couple is going to deal with that in their own way, but it's not necessarily going to end a marriage.
But it is a betrayal of trust.
It's absolutely a betrayal of trust, and that's why it's the biggest. That's why it's so big. So that's why I find it kind of silly when people are saying, oh, it's not natural. Commitment and monogamy are not natural, then why do we have such a powerful emotional response? There are reasons, biological explanations for why we feel jealousy and love, and I think the hurt and betrayal is among those emotions. It makes a lot of sense because there need to be consequences for straying from your partner because you need your partner to stick around to help you raise the children, from an evolutionary perspective. So there are a lot of evolutionary explanations for why couples should stay together.
Well, sometimes people stray because they say the sex in their marriage isn't good, but there are all these other things. How important is sex as to a successful marriage?
Most married couples will tell you that it's very important. Definitely ranks higher than I think it ranks higher than money. I know it ranks higher than children in terms of being important to a marriage. So,
from the earliest times of the marriage to the end.
Well, it's important to a marriage. Your sex life is important to a marriage, but the amount of sex that you have obviously changes over time. I mean, there's a definite sort of newlywed effect, and some studies show a drop of about 50% in the frequency of sex from the first year of marriage to the second. Other studies, maybe 30%. So there's definitely a decline. There's one global study, about 90,000 people, and they documented the newlywed effect in all these different cultures. So it can trail off. And the explanation for that is, there's sort of a chemical explanation. A lot of the the chemicals of romantic and passionate love that are raging through our bodies when we first meet someone, you know, those tend to settle down and fade. So you get into a more settled sex life.
And what about some of the other things? It becomes less of an important option to other things like work and marriage. I mean, work and children, which then take precedence.
Well, and I think, you know, when you study, well, I think the main message that you learn when you study the science of marital sex is that it's a lot more frequent than most people think. Most people think that single people are having all the fun. But having a partner in your bed every night is the fastest way toward regular sex. So married couples are definitely, on average, having far more sex than single people.
Linda, one of our listeners, left a comment on our show page. She said, from early in our marriage, when the kids were small, I've tried to steer away from language that assumes I'm the one who's running the house and raising the children, and change it to, we're doing this together. I think casting one partner as the doer and the other as the helper feeds into a lopsided mindset. We're about to celebrate our 50th anniversary, by the way, and we're still working on the language.
Well, your listener is very wise, because there has been a lot of study of the words we use in conflict discussions and regular discussions, particularly pronouns. And words like we and us are far more predictive of a happy relationship than words like you and I and he and, you know, you did this. So she's absolutely right that, you know, using words like we and us are predictive of a stronger relationship. And it's amazing how often we don't do that when we're arguing. We say things like, you didn't do this, as opposed to, I'm bothered by this. That's a better way to start the fight.
Getting back to sex, I never really want to leave sex anyway. What do you mean when you say that sex, like wealth, is unevenly distributed?
Well, you have about, what is the number? Is it about 15% of the couples are having half of the sex? Isn't that unfair? So you have married couples who are having sex often, 4 or 5 times a week. You have about 10% of the couples that are having sex almost never. You know, you have the low sex couples, and that's a whole other issue. And then you have the people in the middle who are kind of skewing the average. So, you know, what we see is that, you know, frequency of sex is typically associated with a stronger marriage and a happier marriage. It makes sense. You know, the more intimacy you have, the more closeness you have, the better the relationship.
I used to be amused to read the Dear Abby columns, where the first letter would be a wife complaining that her husband no longer wanted to make love to her, and the second letter be from a man who claimed his wife no longer wanted to make love. And I always thought, well, all she had to do was introduce the two couples to each other.
Well, it's funny, but, you know, I do think that there is this big communication gap with couples. It's really interesting. They asked men and women in one large study what they wanted from sex, and it was striking. You would think that, you know, you hear things like, you know, more instructions and, you know, more creativity. This was from the women. This wasn't just from the men. You know, men and women pretty much want the same thing in the bedroom. They just don't necessarily talk about it well enough. The big difference is men want women to initiate more, and women want more kind, nice, flattering words.
So if they do have sex, does it have to be good sex? Or can even bad sex keep a marriage together?
Well, I think that only a couple can decide. You know, this is the thing. If you're married and you're having sex once a week and you're happy with that and it's pretty good sex, I mean, then it works for you. If you're the kind of person who wants to swing from the chandeliers and you've got a partner who doesn't, then that's going to be a source of conflict. So I think, obviously, but these are things you kind of know early on, don't you? Early in the relationship, they're pretty obvious if you're sexually compatible, I think.
I'm wondering whether Viagra is changing all the statistics again.
Well, there are, you know, it's interesting. Even like hip replacements are changing things like infidelity rates, because if you can get your squeak, you know, your aching hip replaced, you're more, you know, you can still cheat if you want to. So we are seeing changes as people get older. We're seeing a little bit more infidelity in older couples, partly because of Viagra, partly because people are just generally healthier, partly because that generation of people, you know, that's the generation that's struggling the most with marriage.
My guest is Tara Parker Pope, the author of the Well column in the New York Times and also the Well blog. Her latest book, For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage, it is published by Dutton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are married people healthier compared to people who are single, widowed, or divorced? I've heard that often.
Yeah, and, you know, in general they are, but the problem with that statistic is that it may in fact be that healthier people just have more opportunities to be married. A person with chronic illness is going to be less likely to get married. Increasingly, they are studying how health and marriage are linked, and what they're finding is that a bad marriage is actually worse for you in terms of health than never marrying at all. That's kind of a new concept. There was for a long time, people thought being single was the least healthy state, but being in a bad marriage is quite bad for your health. It's as bad as, for women, it's as bad as being a pack-a-day smoker. So, you know, a conflict-filled bad marriage with a lack of warmth, that's not good for you.
Although you do point out that people who smoke and drink tend to have more sex, better sex.
What is it? Is it like double? I think it's double the amount of sex. The sinners have more sex, which shouldn't surprise us. I like that statistic. But so, too, you know, jazz lovers also have more sex. So a little smoke, a little drink, a little jazz. Good combination.
I would think that one of the reasons that married couples are healthier is that it doubles resources. And that is not just the money, which would, of course, help for paying medical expenses, but also you can talk things out.
Well, it gives you a social, you know, especially for men who tend to not be as skilled at maintaining long-term friendships and staying in touch with families. Women bring a whole social network into a marriage. You know, typically men are bringing the financial resources, but that's changing now. About 30% of women are earning as much or more than their spouse. I think more than their spouse is the 30% statistic. So, yeah, you know, there are all kinds of things we get out of marriage besides this emotional relationship. And we, you know, marriage is a huge advantage. And I think this is why this issue of same-sex marriage is so often discussed, because it gives people a very distinct advantage, you know, legally, financially, you know, in terms of health. There's a lot of good things that can come out of a good marriage.
You write about the experiments of Robert Levinson trying to determine whether there are any obvious signs of a good or bad relationship. How did he design his experiments?
Yeah, this is interesting. Dr. Levinson is a researcher at Berkeley and a longtime marriage researcher, very well respected. And he had videotapes of different couples, and he knew the outcome. He knew what happened to those couples, but he put them together on a reel, and he showed them to all sorts of people, including marriage counselors, and said, who here is in the good relationship, who's in the bad relationship? Who here is going to stay married and who's going to get divorced? And nobody did. The therapist actually did the worst of anybody, but nobody did any better than a coin toss, I mean, better than chance on this. And the lesson is it's very hard to identify just at first glance what makes a good marriage. You know, we all kind of think we know, but the lesson from the research in marriage is that we often are focusing on the wrong things. We're focusing on, like, how often do you fight, when we should be focusing on how do you start the fight? How does the disagreement start and end? Those are more predictive of a good or bad relationship.
But it's also significant how people meet, isn't it?
Well, it's not how they met. It's how they tell the story of how they met. It's, you know, it's interesting because I actually had a marriage counselor say to me when I was going through my divorce, he wanted to know how my husband and I met. And I was really annoyed by the question because I said, you know, we're having problems now. 20 years ago, not so worried about. And, now, granted, he didn't handle this well, and he was, you know, he wasn't that good at what he did. But what I've since learned is that how you tell the story of how you met can tell you a lot about the state of your relationship. And it's, you know, you can talk about, you know, a trip you took, you know, in the early days. You might say, oh, it was terrible. You know, you didn't ask for directions, and I was stuck out in the rain, and I. After that, I never wanted to go hiking again. Or you might say, oh, this was the worst trip ever. We got lost. We couldn't find our way home. We got stuck in the rain. It's the same miserable hiking trip, but it's clear, it's obvious that the second person is just much happier in the relationship today, even though they're talking about something that happened 20 years ago.
We don't have much time, but we haven't talked about the effect of children on a marriage.
Children do put a tremendous strain on a marriage, and it's a hard thing for people to talk about because children bring so much joy and happiness, and overall, they do make us very happy. But I think couples need to recognize when you are aware that children can erode your marital happiness, I think it's a good motivation to try to work on that.
The statistics show that wealthier couples have a greater struggle after children than middle-class couples. Why would that be?
It's surprising because you would think that people with a lot of financial resources could just hire the nannies and all the things they do. They could hire the help. But they lose more in a sense because if you're the kind of couple that, you know, went out to dinner all the time and went to, you know, traveled and did a lot of fun stuff, when a child comes into your life, that all comes to a screeching halt. And the couples that have less resources from the beginning, they weren't doing all that, so they're not missing out on as much. They don't feel like they are. The child doesn't sort of ruin their lives at the same degree.
Couples then tell themselves, well, when the kids become teenagers and can fend for themselves, we'll be able to do more things together. But teenagers cause their own kinds of problems.
Oh, sure. Teenagers take up a tremendous... Anybody who's got a teenager knows that. But what's really important, I think, from the scientific study of parenting is looking at the empty nest and what happens when children leave a home. Couples do get happier. Marital satisfaction does rise. The empty nest is a very happy place. But what's interesting is, why is it happy? Couples are not spending a lot of extra time together. They're not taking that time they spent on their kids and spending it with each other. What happens is the quality of the time they spend together is happier, it's better, it's less stressful. And that's a lesson we can learn. We don't need more time with our partner as parents. We just need better time with our partner as parents.
Are heterosexual relationships any different, ultimately, than gay and lesbian couples?
You know, there's a fair amount of research on same-sex couples and, you know, comparing them to heterosexual couples. And there are so many things that are similar about the relationships. They, you know, love, argue, and, you know, celebrate good and bad times pretty much the same way, you know, same-sex couples do as heterosexual couples. But what we see in same-sex couples is that we don't have the struggles over gender, the male and female sort of disagreements. And so we recognize that a lot of the problems in a marriage really are about power struggles, not so much gender struggles. So there's a lot. I did devote a chapter to same-sex couples. I think there's really a lot of interesting things we can learn. And hopefully, as, you know, more people, you know, recognize same-sex relationships, it'll be studied more and we'll learn even more.
I'm assuming that a lot of people are looking at this book in hopes of finding clues as to how to improve their marriages or even marry well. Are they going to find out anything of that sort?
Well, I think that you said it exactly right. I think you're going to find some clues. I think that you're going to see things that are either going on in your own relationship that are positive or negative. You know, I think the main message of the scientific study of marriage, you know, one of the really kind of the shifts that we're seeing right now is that they're studying what makes relationships work, the good things, you know, what goes, instead of just focusing on the conflict and the things that go wrong in marriage, focusing on the things that go right. And, you know, we're seeing that positivity and celebrating good times, capitalizing on the positive events in your life, all of these things go a very long way in making a marriage better.
We don't have any time, but I want to read one more message from a listener. Rich in Manhattan says, my girlfriend and I have been together for more than 2 years now and are very much in love. I think, though, that we're both somewhat skeptical about the institution of marriage because both of our sets of parents divorced. Mm-hmm. Mine when I was pretty young, hers more recently. Are there any special statistics for couples such as ours?
There are, and it is definitely a risk factor. When your risk for divorce goes way up when you're both divorced, or you're both products of divorce, your parents have divorced, but you're aware of it and you can obviously work on other things to improve it. And, you know, if you don't get married, that's fine. Just stay connected, stay together. You know, you don't have to necessarily have the legal document.
Tara Parker Pope's latest book is called For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage. It's published by Dutton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's always fun to be here. Thanks.